From News Talk 580 1059 KMJ, this is the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition. Here is Mark Kepler.
This week on the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition.
Another midterm election, but are California's voters engaged and paying attention? There are fewer but still significant ballot measures to consider. And the legislative seats up for grabs could alter the look of the California legislature. With Governor Brown well ahead in his race for an unprecedented fourth term, the state's down-ticket races are getting more attention than normal. So who are California's likely voters? And where are they leaning on the various races and propositions as the election nears? We'll discuss the upcoming November election with Mark Baldessari of the Public Policy Institute of California and Dan Walters, political columnist for the Sacramento Bee.
We'll also hear from John Ellis, political reporter for the Fresno Bee, Pete Weber, board member with California Forward, and Nate Monroe, political science professor with UC Merced.
Additional funding for the Maddie Report made possible by a grant from Paramount Agricultural Companies, growing healthy food for you and your family.
From the California Channel at the State Capitol, Valley PBS, and the Maddie Institute, it's the Maddie Report with Executive Director of the Maddie Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome. Our guest is Mark Baldessari, President and CEO of the Public Policy Institute of California, who directs the PPIC Statewide Survey, a large-scale public opinion project designed to develop an in-depth profile of the social, economic, and political forces at work in California elections. So we're delighted to have you back on
Thank
the Maddie
you.
Report.
Nice to be here.
So you've been tracking voter registration for some time. Have you noticed any significant shifts or trends?
There are a couple of them that come to mind. One is that we have seen an increasing number of Latinos, in particular, also Asian Americans, but Latinos more than any other group, in terms of racial and ethnic change. And then in terms of party identification, we've seen an increasing number of voters who are no party preference.
So what's happening to the Republicans and the Democrats?
Shrinking. Republicans shrinking more than Democrats. The last Secretary of State report showed that the number of Republicans in the state had declined to 28%. The number of Republicans then compared to a few years ago down 2 points. Number of Democrats also down 1 point from 44% to 43%, and now there are 23% of Californians who describe themselves as no party preference.
But those trends have been going on, not just for the last few years, but for a while, haven't they?
Yeah. There seemed to be a little bit of an acceleration in it as I looked at the numbers. And if you think about what this means, if you've got 28% Republicans and 23% no party preference and increase of 3 points, but from 2010 and the independents, if they increase another 3 points in 4 years, which would be by 2018, and Republicans continue to decline, we could have more people who are no party preference in California than registered as Republicans.
Republicans become the third party in the state. Well, what about, you know, likely voters? Not all registered voters vote. So what are the characteristics of the likely voter?
The likely voter tends to be older, more affluent, better educated, more likely to be a homeowner, to have lived in their residence for some period of time, and more likely to be white.
So I cringe a little bit when you say older, because I think you define that as 55 and above.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Likely voters, of course, vary from election to election, but we look at people who are just what we describe as frequent voters, and they have a profile that's different from the average Californian.
So what about things like demographic characteristics like ethnicity among likely voters? For example, Latinos.
Yeah. So, you know, we see maybe around 18% of Latinos, we see about 18% Latino voters in our election profiles, and that tends to be a number which has been fairly stable over the last few years, hasn't grown a lot, but is sharply lower than what the potential is.
What's the potential
in the population? Well, the potential could be as much as in somewhere in the low 30s. If you look at what the population profile is, but certainly a combination of whether you're talking about immigration status as well as people who still have the potential to register to vote, we expect that that will be the fastest growing group of voters.
So your studies show that Latinos, while they generally vote Democratic, there's a large majority, or not saying majority, there's a large number, percentage, that are view themselves as conservative.
Yeah.
So why the disconnect? You'd think they'd be registering as Republicans.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think the challenge for the Republican Party in California is really around immigration policy. And for the last two decades, the Republicans in California have not been able to attract Latino voters, even moderate to conservative Latino voters, because overwhelmingly, Latino voters have been in favor of a path to citizenship. And the Republican Party nationally and earlier in the state was not in favor, was in favor, had a more of a harsh tone around undocumented immigrants, and that's really hurt Republican registration of Latinos.
We're talking with Mark Baldessari, head of the nonprofit and nonpartisan PPIC, who publishes the well-respected PPIC statewide survey. Let's talk about the ever-increasing independent voters. What did your statewide survey find out about this independent voter?
They tend to be younger than the overall voter profile. They tend to be more likely than male than female as well. And they tend to be fairly highly educated and middle to upper middle income, and they are, most of them describe themselves as moderate politically. Most Republicans describe themselves conservative, many Democrats liberal. I think what's different about independents is they put themselves in the middle of the political spectrum.
And it's interesting, that's a growing trend. I think your studies show that from 1994 to today, it's about 11% increase.
Yeah,
it's pretty significant.
It's been a huge change, and now we've got the top two primary, so, you know, another reason why people don't have to register as Republican or Democratic. Most younger voters don't really affiliate with a party. Most new voters who tend to be younger are registering as no party preference.
It's interesting. I was talking to a political pundit. He was saying that it's actually might be better for folks to put an I next to their name as an R, but it might be easier to attract voters statewide that way.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's talk about the electorate generally. What is their feeling going into this election, and has it changed since 2010 and 12, and what impact on the election?
Yeah. So the mood is much more positive than it was in 2012 and especially in 2010. More people saying the state's going in the right direction, more people saying that they expect the economy to be in good shape over the course of the next year, and fewer people saying the state's budget situation is a problem, and fewer people saying the economy is the state's biggest problem. The new problem that's emerged is water. You know, that's the number two issue now. So that's a big change.
Right behind jobs in the economy.
Right behind jobs in the economy is the number two issue. In some parts of the state,
it is jobs in the economy. Well, I want to ask you quickly about the California propositions. Anything surprise you there in your polling?
Yeah, you know, Proposition 2, which is the rainy day fund, but it's not called the rainy day fund on the ballot. We had less than 50% support. That surprised me because whenever we've asked about rainy day funds, it gets very strong support. But of the four measures we asked about, Prop 47, which would reduce some criminal sentences from felonies to misdemeanors, had the most support, 62%. So maybe that surprised me even more than anything else, was that we are really at a point in time where people are warming up to the idea of changing our criminal justice system in California.
It looks like a big change from the three strikes of, you know, put them away, and now it's like it's costing us too much. Maybe we need to think of some other ideas.
It's all about the cost and the fact that crime, only 2% say it's the biggest problem facing the state.
Wow, 2%. Yeah. Okay, last question. We only have about a minute left in the segment. I want to ask you about the races in November. Which statewide office is the most competitive?
Probably the nonpartisan race for superintendent of public schools, which a Democrat will face a Democrat, although neither of them are describing themselves as Democrats. But that's the one that seems to, you know, have attracted the most attention right now. But, you know, people are looking at the controller's race because you don't have incumbents running in that race as well.
So two close races to watch. Well, I want to thank Mark Baldessari for being here. Up next, we're now joined by Dan Walters, veteran Capitol Observer and political columnist for the Sacramento Bee. Welcome back to the Maddie Report,
Dan.
Thank
you.
Well, Governor Brown appears to have a commanding lead over the Republican nominee, Neil Kashkari. But one statewide race that's turning out to be quite competitive is the race for state superintendent between Tom Torlakson and Marshall Tuck. They're both Democrats, as a matter of fact. It's statistically basically a dead heat. It's attracting a lot of money. What are the issues that are driving the interest in this race?
I think what's driving the race and maybe the interest in the race as well is it is the a front in a much larger battle in California over the direction of public education. Marshall Tuck represents the insurgent part of this battle. He's being promoted and financed by people who have been fighting this battle for years and years, mostly wealthy Democrats, as a matter of fact, who believe that the public school system of California needs to go into a different direction to become more flexible, less hidebound, encourage charter schools, encourage more parental involvement, and so forth. And then Mr. Torlakson represents the establishment, the education establishment. He is the education establishment, former teacher, very closely aligned with the California Teachers Association. And this battle has been fought on a number of fronts for a number of years. It's been fought in the legislature over legislation. It's been fought at the local level, and it's been fought even today is already still being fought at the state school board over regulations that will govern the new financing formula that puts more money into schools with poor children. And this is just another front in that war.
And we've got that L.A. case.
That's part of it. The case, I should say, well, one of the other fronts is in the courts. The decision by a judge in Los Angeles that the teacher tenure system is unconstitutional. Other court battles that are pending. One over whether the California Teachers Association can continue to get money from teachers for their political activities. I mean, this is a war that's been going on, I'd say, to one degree or intensity another, for two or three decades in California. And they have fought and they have fought and they have fought. Sometimes one side wins, sometimes the other side wins. This is just the latest battle.
We have another interesting race for Secretary of State with Republican Pete Peterson against Democrat Alex Padilla. What are the differences in that race?
There actually are not an awful lot of differences. The two candidates agree, basically, that the Secretary of State's office is not operating well and needs a big overhaul. They don't even particularly disagree on what that should be, that they need better technology, that they need to be more attentive, more customer-friendly. They need to clean up the systems that of access to campaign data and that sort of thing. So there's not an awful lot that separates the two ideologically or in prescriptions for the office. It all boils down to kind of, I guess, a personality thing. Mr. Padilla is obviously a politician. He's a state senator. Mr. Peterson's kind of a non-politician, so it kind of boils down to that and so forth. It's interesting only in that the office clearly does need a lot of change, and these both of them are proposing it.
Yeah, it's interesting. The Pew Charitable Trust ranked California's election performance 49th, so change needs to have happened there. Let's go down and talk about some other down-ticket Republican races. You've got Swearingen running for state controller. Are these down-ticket races really more of a test run for maybe running for the Senate in 2016 or the governor's race in 2018? Are they viable candidates?
Yes, I think that all of these down-ballot constitutional officers, as they're called, are basically stepping stone offices. You step from office to office to office. For example, Gray Davis, who was governor before he was recalled, had been lieutenant governor, he had been state controller, and then he'd been a state legislature. So there's a kind of a ladder in this, and these constitutional offices are a ladder. Jerry Brown was Secretary of State.
Bill Lockyer did a lot.
Bill Lockyer's been in a couple of these different offices. So yeah, that's the import of it. It's not. Yes, they might have some something to do once they get in office, but mostly they kind of plot and scheme how to run for other offices.
You know, it's interesting. Republicans are nominating some people that consider to have more moderate views, like Pete Peterson and Ashley Swearingen. Is the Republican Party kind of trying to change its image, maybe moving a little bit away from the Tea Party? Is the Tea Party losing its grip?
I think that the leadership of the Republican Party, such as it is trying to change. They realize that demography is not their friend, that if they don't start getting some voters among Latinos and among other non-white groups, among the younger voters, that they're doomed. Their voter registration's down to about 28% now, and they've got to make change. However, there is resistance to that change. Not so much Tea Party. The Tea Party is a fairly recent phenomenon. This is really kind of an old battle within the Republican Party. It goes back to 50s and 60s, as a matter of fact. And the party...
Well, it's not quite the Goldwater-Rockefeller split, but...
It's kind of like the Goldwater-Rockefeller split. It's between the people who believe that you have to adhere to principle regardless of the outcome of the election, and the people who believe that you need to be more flexible, more moderate, kind of like Ken Matty was, as a matter of fact. And that was one of the fights that he fought when he was in office as well. So it's an old battle. This is just the newest incarnation of it, but there is some urgency about it because the Republicans have fallen to such a low state in the state.
What do you think the Democrats' chances are of winning back supermajorities or keeping supermajorities in the Assembly and Senate?
I think their chances of retaining the supermajority in the Assembly are pretty good. They have two seats that are at risk, but the Republicans have a seat or two that's also at risk. And I kind of think that's probably going to wash out, that the 55 seats they have now is going to wind up 55 or 54. The Senate's a different kettle of fish. The numbers kind of work against the Democrats. Remember, only half the senators are up every 2 years. This happens to be the cycle in which the Republicans have a chance to make some gains. And also, the redistricting plan that was done by a redistricting commission a few years ago takes effect for half of the Senate just this year. For example, that redistricting shifts one seat from Democrats to Republicans automatically. It shifts a seat from San Francisco over into the interior part of California that will be Republican. So Republicans are assured of one seat gain. They've already picked up another in a special election, and they are favored, not locked in, but favored to win what had been a Democratic seat in Orange County. If that happens, then the supermajority vanishes in Sacramento.
We're talking with political columnist Dan Walters. There are fewer initiatives on the ballot than normal, but they still could have a significant impact on public policy. One big one is the big one, a $7.5 billion water bond. Despite its size, though, it takes pains to distance itself from the governor's Twin Tunnels project. So I assume that was because of political necessity. But doesn't that ensure that this is just a partial fix and that we're going to be revisiting water issues in the next several years?
We have been visiting water issues for 150 years in California, and we will probably continue to visit water issues for the next 150 years. One little correction. It's not an initiative. It's a ballot measure, but it's not an initiative because it was placed on by the legislature. And you have to kind of differentiate that. No, it's just another step in one of this medieval war over water in California, and it'll never be resolved. All you can do is make incremental changes and hope that it kind of eases the situation for a while until the next conflict comes up. This water bond is really a pretty small part of the picture. It basically does a lot of things that probably need to be done. But it probably will pass, that the polls indicate it'll probably pass, but it's not the big water fix, because there is no big water fix. Chasing the Holy Grail that you'll never find. So it does a few things, and we won't know whether it does the right things for decades, basically, because that's how water works. It's a long process. But the Twin Tunnel project is another fix, potential fix, although it's very controversial, as everyone knows. And then there are also looming battles over groundwater regulation. Mm-hmm. That's another thing the legislature did this year. And also, down the line, there's going to be a battle over water rights. I mean, the water rights that have been handed out by the state over the last century, about three times as much as there is water.
Right.
And so all of these things are parts of a very complex puzzle. In the meantime, you have to deal with weather, which you can't really predict. There's a new study out that says that what would happen to California if this was a 75-year drought? Right. Believe it or not, we would survive, according to the study. So it just goes on and on and on and on. It's a process, not a product. So this is part of the process.
So we'll call it drops in the bucket, or right. Drop in the bucket. Okay, let's talk about Prop 2, the Rainy Day Fund. A lot of people are surprised that it doesn't have more support. I think it's polling at about 43% support at this point. But yet people say the state budget is a problem, the budget process is a big problem, but not a lot of support for Prop 2. Why is that?
Well, it hasn't been developed. There's been no campaign for it, for one thing. It's a complex thing. It's not a simple thing. It's a proposed fix to the state's budget volatility, the fact that tax revenues go up and down very widely because of the economy changes, and also we are very, very dependent on a handful of wealthy people. 1% of California's taxpayers finance a third of the entire state budget, and their fortunes are tied to the stock market. So they go up and down, the budget revenue goes up and down, and this is a fix to put money away so that when it goes down, you have money in the cushion. There's some real legitimate questions about whether it's enough of a fix or whether it's simply a symbolic gesture. In the meantime, the voters don't know. They yes, the budget's a big problem. Is this the right fix? And until somebody actually convinces them, they're going to be a little skeptical.
So let's talk about Prop 45. That proposition talks about the insurance premiums being regulated by the insurance commissioner. The proponents say, listen, rates have gone up 185% since 2002, five times the rate of inflation. The 35 other states have similar measures. We don't in California. So what's the argument against 45?
That we already have rate regulation essentially from two other state agencies, Covered California, which operates Obamacare, and the state's Department of Managed Care, which oversees HMOs. And basically, this is a turf battle. The insurance commissioner has been kind of frozen out because so much of healthcare now is either comes under Obamacare or comes under managed care, and he doesn't play a role in those things. He only really gets to regulate individual healthcare policies, which are a declining part of the business. He wants to enlarge his empire to include some other things, and he has the assistance of an organization down in Southern California that has benefited tremendously from so-called intervener fees from his office and other rate cases, and this would give them an opportunity to get new intervener fees. So there's a legitimate question as to whether this is just an empire building or whether it's a needed rate regulation authority.
But Covered California tries to negotiate rates. It can't regulate rates, correct?
It doesn't directly regulate rates, but in the process of negotiating those rates, it basically sets the standard. And the people at Covered California, they're not officially opposed to it, but they are basically expressing great displeasure about somebody trying to get in on their turf.
Quick comments about two other propositions I want to talk about. One was Prop 46, and that increases the medical negligence award from $250,000, which was set in 1975, to $1.1 million. And they came up with that number based on the rate of inflation since 1975. Well, fair, necessary? I guess it depends on what side of the fence you're sitting on.
I suppose, it depends on what side of the fence. This is the latest effort, essentially, by the trial lawyers lobby to change this cap on non-economic damages, pain and suffering damages. Damages from $250,000 that was set in 1975 under a bill signed by Jerry Brown, by the way.
Which I think he regrets. He sent a note, I think in the 90s, that's saying he thought maybe he made a mistake when he signed that measure.
Well, if you're interested in historical trivia, the proponents of that offered to put a cost of living escalator in the legislation back in 1975, and the trial lawyer lobby turned it down because they thought the whole thing would be thrown out by the courts and it would be easier, or it'd be easier to beat it in a referendum. So they turned that down, and now they've regretted that for the last 39 years.
That's an oops moment. What about 47, which reduces some crimes from felonies to misdemeanors? Is that really proof that the cost of incarceration is becoming more important than the tough-on-crime narrative?
This is an effort by criminal justice reformers, opposed by the police, by the way, and the law enforcement community, most of it anyway, not all of it, most of it. It's trying to do some things that have been proposed in the legislature over the years that have not been successful because most legislators don't want to buck the law enforcement community. So one side says it's reform, the other side said it's going to go soft on crime. So take your pick.
Okay, well, I want to thank Dan Walters for joining us, as well as Mark Baldessari, President and CEO of the Public Policy Institute of California.
Up next, what will the November election mean for the Valley? We'll talk to Nate Monroe, a political science professor with UC Merced, John Ellis, political reporter with the Fresno Bee, and Pete Weber, board member with California Forward.
From News Talk 580-1059 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Here is Mark Kepler.
Welcome back. So what would the November races mean for the Valley? We've got three viewpoints. Pete Weber is a board member with California Forward and former executive committee chair of the California Partnership for the San Joaquin Valley. Nate Monroe is a political science professor from UC Merced, and John Ellis is a political reporter for the Fresno Bee who's on the road today on his way to Bakersfield. So welcome all of you to the Matty Report Valley Views Edition.
Thanks for having me.
So John, we'll start with you first. Don't want to stay focused on the role, but if you can answer this question, it looks like Governor Brown is cruising to re-election. So what are the Valley implications of an unprecedented fourth term for Jerry Brown?
Well, I think it could be worse. I think this is probably the best that we could hope for. He's never paid a ton of attention to the Valley, but he does have several connections here, long-time connections. Rick Lehman and Jim Costa are just a couple of people that come to mind. So I think the alternative, just picture Gavin Newsom in that position or Kamala Harris or something, and I think that it would probably be even worse for the Valley. So it's not going to be fantastic. He's never paid a ton of attention to us, but it could be a lot worse.
Professor Monroe, what do you think? Is Merced, the North Valley, going to do better than the Valley generally with a Jerry Brown in the fourth term?
Well, I think that, you know, certainly he's turned out to be a pretty moderate governor, a pretty, you know, conservative Democrat as they go. And so in some sense, you know, Brown's politics, I think, match the Valley's politics better than probably, you know, several of the governors that we've had before this. And, you know, as a result, he's also had some good relationships with some of the Valley state legislators up in that area, with Canella and with Gray. With some of the folks there, I think, you know, that relationship has been built and is good. So I think looking in the future, it's, you know, like you said, it could be a lot worse.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's, you know, kind of bipartisan there because, you know, Gray's a Democrat and Canella's a Republican. So Pete, we also have Dinah Dooley, who's in a very important position in the Brown administration as Secretary of HHS. What do you think? Do you think a fourth term for Governor Brown is going to be good or bad for the Valley?
Yeah, well, first, Mark, I don't think of it so much as a fourth term. I think of it more as a second term of Governor Brown's version 2.0. We have a very different Jerry Brown leading the state this time, and I think that's a net plus for the Valley. This is a Jerry Brown that has appropriately, in our view, put fiscal discipline at the top of his priorities. California Forward worked with the administration to develop Proposition 2, the Rainy Day Fund, that is now on the ballot. The Valley does much better when there is fiscal discipline in Sacramento. This is also a governor that is not focused on our limitations, but on our possibilities. His current commitment to Proposition 1, that the water bond, is, I think, a clear example of that. And any governor that wants to fix California's water problems is a friend of the Valley. I worked on the water bond with the administration, and they get it, that we have to implement a comprehensive long-term set of solutions, and this water bond will help us jumpstart implementation of the needed solutions. So net, I think Jerry Brown has been good for the Valley and will be good for the Valley.
So, yeah, Governor Brown 2.0 is good for the Valley. Well, let me ask Professor Monroe, given the governor's apparent strength, more attention is really being focused on some of the down-ticket races. One race with obvious Valley implications is the race for controller, pitting Mayor CEO Ashley Swearingen, the Republican, against Board of Equalization member Betty Yee, the Democrat. What do you think her election or even a competitive loss would mean for the Valley?
Well, I think it means less in terms of Valley implications. I think it means a lot less in terms of the actual controller position than it does for the prospects of Swearingen to go on and run for an office, you know, a statewide office in the future. That does have more implications for the Valley, where, you know, the controller obviously has some hand in lots of different things, but not the ability to sort of distribute resources in the same way that some of the other statewide offices would. So I think, you know, as you point out, a competitive loss might be, in some ways, almost as good as a close win, if it means that it sets Swearingen up to go on and run for, you know, another higher office in the future where she'd be successful.
So Pete, you've been involved with the California Partnership for the San Joaquin Valley. You're now on a statewide organization called Cal Forward. What do you think? A competitive loss is as good as a win for Ashley Swearingen?
Well, let me preface that California Forward does not endorse candidates. So, you know, what I'm going to say is personal. And I'm going to say that, you know, perhaps a little different view than Nate expressed. I think that a win would be very important for the state of California and would be therefore very important and useful for the Valley. Governor Brown, I think, done quite a bit to restore some fiscal stability to the state, but there is much more that needs to be done, and he needs a partner in the controller's office to help him do that, someone who has the executive experience and who is fiercely independent, and I think he would have such a partner in Ashley Swearingen. As she's made clear as mayor of Fresno and during this campaign, she's beholden to no one. She certainly understands government finance, and she understands economic development, which is crucially important because economic growth goes hand-in-hand with fiscal stability. She knows that the claims that the state now has a balanced budget is true only in the mythical world of California government accounting. If we used accrual accounting, which any serious institution, public or private, should do, we'd see that our state budget is still far from balanced, and that still badly needs fixing if California is going to return to its glory days. So, yeah, I think it's important for Ashley to win. If she doesn't win, I do concur with Nate that a close win would position her for a subsequent a run for another important state office.
Well, John Ellis, you've been a political reporter for the Fresno Bee. You've seen Ashley Swearingen up close. What do you think? What are the implications of either a win by Ashley Swearingen or a competitive loss? What does that mean for the Valley?
Well, I don't think it's going to be a whole lot for the Valley. I don't think we would have a voice in state government in probably for the first time, I guess, in a constitutional office. I think Bill Jones was probably the last time he was in that position. And so I just look at it from more of a political point of view. I just think that if she could show well, it might be bode well for the future of this part of the state as far as candidates go. She could maybe pave the way, showing that somebody from this part of the state could be competitive or possibly even win. You know, I think, everybody remembers Bill Jones, that was Secretary of State. She could maybe advance us a little bit, maybe break out of that mold that our statewide office holders only can come from the Bay Area or Los Angeles.
Yeah. Pete, I want to ask you, a lot has been talked about with Mayor Swearingen changing her designation from mayor of Fresno to, CEO. What do you think about that? Is that going to hurt her with her Fresno base?
You know, Mark, I really have no opinion on the political side of that question. I do know the state controller does not, should not represent a particular piece of California's geography. What's important is that she has the financial acumen and the executive experience to be a superb state controller. And I think she's positioning herself to be the controller for the entire state. So I don't know. There may be some net loss. You know, some people might find that offensive. But I think net-net, it'll be a gain for her to be seen as somebody who's going to be looking after the entire state.
John Ellis, political reporter for the Fresno Bee, what do you think? There's a lot of talk about Mayor Swearingen dropping the reference to Fresno in her ballot designation. Any Valley implications in terms of her support?
I think probably that I think I'm going to hear more than endorsing Guang Zhang for county supervisor. Honestly, I think only Fresno people will probably get offended by it. So people outside of here might snigger at it, but I just think when somebody gets in that voting booth and they haven't done a lot of research and they see mayor/CEO, it might be more helpful for Swearingen.
Yeah. Professor Monroe, what do you think from a political standpoint that change in designation, net gain or net loss for Mayor Swearingen?
I agree with Pete. In the short run, I think, you know, it's probably a net gain in the sense that it highlights something that, you know, will cue voters in that particular position. Long term, I doubt it has much of an impact. You know, people, I think, probably have a pretty short memory about things like that, even if they have their feelings hurt a little about her, you know, moving away from the title of mayor of Fresno. And to be honest, you know, at the end of the day, I doubt it looks very much like her future in politics is much, much broader than than Fresno or the Valley. Most of those folks won't know anything about it. So I think, you know, probably net gain in the end.
You know, Professor Monroe, I want to also ask you about a comment made by State Republican Chair Jim Brulte when he accused Mayor Swearengen of being felony stupid for not endorsing the Republican candidate for governor, Neil Kashkari. You think it was felony stupid, or was it misdemeanor clever by positioning herself to be more attractive to California's independent and moderate voters?
I think it's misdemeanor clever. I think, you know, certainly Brulte may have felt very frustrated by it. And, you know, there is some sacrifice there from, you know, there's probably some, you know, minor support that she might have withheld as a result of that. But at the end of the day, you know, she's a great chance for Republicans to, you know, elect a sort of rising star to a statewide office. And it was a politically smart move for her in a state that is dominated by moderates and Democrats. And I think it was the right thing for her to do.
Pete,
Mark?
Yeah, sure, go ahead.
I'm back. This is John. I don't know if you want me there, but I was going to lay on that. I didn't call it totally stupid, but I just don't know how much weight it carried with the audience that Swearengen would need to be paying attention to that message. I think, unfortunately, it angered a lot of the base of the GOP. And they're the ones who put her names on barriers. They're the ones who get out the vote in their local counties. And they got mad at her. And I don't know if enough Democrats or independents were paying attention to the Republican convention or what was going on there for it to be a net gain for her. Although I understand what she's trying to do, I just don't know if it got to the target audience.
Yeah, well, there are also an awful lot of independents out there that aren't with either party that, you know, maybe might be attracted to the news that a Republican statewide office seeker is not endorsing the full ticket. It's an interesting story nonetheless. Let me ask Pete, I wanted to ask you about other statewide offices that you think might be impactful to the Valley. Which ones are you looking at that you think are going to be the most important for the Valley?
Well, I think there's a couple that are very important. First, superintendent of public instruction, where, you know, as you know, two Democrats want the job. I mean, we all have to remember California is ranked 45th in the nation K-12 education. California has 2.5 million children who cannot read and do math at grade level. There's good reason why every major newspaper in the state and every major education reform organization is endorsing the challenger, Marshall Tuck. The incumbent, Alan Torlakson, is a very nice man, but he's been in office for 4 years and nothing has changed. By contrast, the challenger, Tuck, was given the responsibility of turning around the worst-performing schools in Los Angeles, and within 5 years, graduation rates at those schools had increased by 60%. That's the kind of change we need in the state of California. So I think that's hugely important. The second one is Secretary of State. California has become largely apathetic about elections, if not downright cynical. And there is no incumbent in this race. One of the contenders is a termed-out senator. The second one runs the Davenport Institute for Public Engagement at Pepperdine University. And that's Pete Peterson, and he's devoted the last several years of his life to finding pathways to increase civic participation. I think that's very important for the state and for the Valley. He's running as the state's chief engagement officer. I've read many of his papers on how to make government more transparent and less subject to influence by special interests, and how to apply technology to make civic engagement and the electoral process more accessible to voters, particularly to younger voters who seem to be among the most cynical and apathetic. And I would recommend listeners Google Pete Peterson to see if they like his ideas. I certainly do, and I think he'd make a difference in California.
Okay, Professor Monroe, it's very clear that Pete Weber is supporting Marshall Tuck for State Superintendent of Schools and Pete Peterson for Secretary of State. Any thoughts on these races?
Let me touch on the Secretary of State to add something. I agree with what Pete said, and I want to expand that to point out that the Secretary of State also is the arbiter and sort of keeper of business license applications and corporate, filings for corporations and other things that, they're not thought of as the flagship role of the Secretary of State, are really critical, and they're really critical for people in the Valley. Because, as it currently stands, I don't know if either any of you have tried to do any of this, but I've recently been sort of trying to go through the Secretary of State to do some founding for nonprofits, for nonprofit corporations and other things. And it's pretty unwieldy. I mean, given that we're the state of technology, there's not a whole lot of sort of streamlined online access to being able to, create new business opportunities, create new foundations. And I think that's what's really at stake, in a new period of economic growth, we need to be able to make that bureaucracy as sort of efficient as possible so that, citizens in the Valley and other places can grow their businesses and expand opportunities for economic growth.
Okay, well, up next, a discussion of some Valley races and the propositions on the November ballot that may be especially important to the San Joaquin Valley. That conversation in a moment. This is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition.
From News Talk 580 1059 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Here is Mark Kepler.
Welcome back. We're talking about the November election and how it might impact the San Joaquin Valley with Nate Monroe, a political science professor from UC Merced, John Ellis, the political reporter for the Fresno Bee, and Pete Weber, a board member with California Forward. Want to ask John Ellis with the Fresno Bee a quick question about some Valley races. John, which races do you see as most interesting?
Probably there's just two of them, and they're in the same part of the Valley, and that would be the 21st congressional race between Amanda Renteria and the incumbent Republican David Baudeo, and then the state Senate race with incumbent Republican Andy Bidak and the challenger Democrat Luis Chavez of Fresno. I don't even know. There are signs that are indicating, at least with the 21st, it may not be competitive, which I think will speak volumes as to the future of that seat. I think if Baudeo can post a convincing victory over somebody who has more than $1 million, as Vice President Joe Biden coming in for her, then I think he is showing himself to be pretty much in a commanding position in a district that is dominated by Democrats. And as well as the Senate seat covers a lot of similar territory and a similar deficit for Republicans, 20-point registration advantage for Democrats in that district. Bidak won it in a special election. I think if he can win in a general election, I think it just shows to the Democrats that you can register voters, but you can't make them vote. And they have a job to do, a tremendous job to do in that part of the state. Kern County, Kings, part of Fresno, and Uribe Tulare, they need to actually get those registered voters to the poll, find a way to solve that problem to win back a seat that I think they view as theirs.
Mm-hmm. It would be very, very interesting given the Democratic registration advantage in those seats. Let me turn our attention to the propositions, John. Quickly, Prop 1, the water bond. The folks you're talking to, do they think this is going to solve the Valley's water problems?
Well, it depends on who you talk to. I think some of the people out here are just so desperate for new storage that I think if they see that $2.7 billion in there earmarked for storage, I think they think that that's a fact. Bidak said to me that it's a good down payment. It'll get us started. Hopefully the Sites Reservoir up in Coosa County can be constructed, possibly get a start on Temperance Flat. They seem to think that will be able to get us through these dry years more effectively with better water management. But, politics always plays into this. There's so much more than just building dams and stuff. But I do think that everybody seems to be on board here. A lot of compromise in this legislation, in this ballot initiative. And I think that there's a lot to like and dislike for both Democrats and Republicans. But I think that everybody seems to be focused on what they like. So I think it's a net positive.
Pete, I know Pete Weber with California Forward and former lead executive with the California Partnership for the San Joaquin Valley. I know you've been very involved with water issues. That $2.7 billion for water storage is that how that money is going to be allocated is going to be decided by the California Water Commission. It's not an absolute that it's going to be going to a new dams like Temperance Flat. It could go to underground storage. What are your thoughts on that?
I think the right thing is going to happen. Look, I'm a member of a group called the California Water Fix Coalition that includes representatives from most of the water major water agencies in California, as well as environmental and business organizations and major water associations and think tanks such as Aqua and the Delta Vision Foundation and so on. And I have seen more convergence on water than I have in the preceding three decades. I mean, people really, you know, have come to terms with the fact that we have to address these issues long term, specifically with regards to storage. I think there's very, very broad acceptance. Certainly, the administration, understands this, that the current status on storage is not sustainable, neither is the current status on conveyance. So both conveyance and storage need to be addressed. But all of that needs to be addressed in the context of a comprehensive solution to California's water issues that includes everything. It includes conservation, water use efficiency, and so on and so forth. Most of that is embedded in the California Water Action Plan, which is very consistent with a paper that was issued by our California Water Fix Coalition. I think we're moving in the right direction. I agree with John that, he quoted Andy Bidek as saying, this is a down payment, and it is. It is a down payment, which, by the way, a down payment that will leverage other resources because, for example, on dams, this water bond provides not more than 50% of the cost of any surface storage that is built. So somebody else is going to have to come up with the other 50%. I'm very supportive. One more quick comment, and that is, this is an indication, I think, the water bond is an indication of the fact that California politics is changing for the better because this is a bond measure that was approved by unanimously by the state Senate and by all but two of the members of the assembly. That's huge. Big victory for California.
You got to wonder who those two are. I don't know who they are, but they're definitely in the minority. Professor Monroe, there's nothing like a drought to focus one's attention on water issues. But what about the governor's twin tunnel proposal for the Delta? Is that in political hibernation? Because it's not part of this bond measure. Or is it just dead on arrival?
No, I think it's in political hibernation. I mean, I think this touches on something that Pete mentioned, which is the solution really has to be a combination of dealing with conveyance and storage issues. And, the water bond, I think its many virtues, really doesn't fundamentally solve some of the problems that are related to, simply moving the water from the north of the Delta or the Delta to the west side of the valley. And unfortunately, the storage, part of the storage component in large part does not solve a lot of the issues that plague that sort of very dry, very desperate west side, particularly with respect to agriculture, right? Because all, the water's got to come out of the Sierra and in some way get effectively through or around the Delta to be conveyed down, there, at least as currently stands. And so if it's not the Twin Tunnel project itself, some other solution to solve some of these conveyance issues is going to have to be proposed. And so I don't think it's DOA, but I think it's far from a certainty that that's going to be the solution that we use.
All right. Well, I want to ask each of you, and we'll start with you, Pete, about the other propositions on the ballot, like the one, for example, Prop 48, which seems to be very focused on the value of the Madeira casino, for lack of a better way to say it. Which propositions that are on the ballot do you think are going to be particularly impactful for the Valley? And I want to give each guest about 30 seconds to give their answer.
Okay, so I'm going to focus on Proposition 2, the Budget Stabilization Act, also known as the Rainy Day Fund, because I think it's extremely important for the Valley and for the state. California has one of the most volatile revenue streams in the nation, huge peaks and valleys. Proposition 2 isn't going to reduce that volatility, but it will manage that volatility. It's going to do three things: capture spikes in revenue, build a bigger reserve to stabilize the budget in economic downturns, and give the state a regular way to pay down its debts. And I think that's important for the Valley because the Valley does much better when there is economic stability in Sacramento.
Okay, well, John Ellis, political reporter with the Fresno Bee, which proposition has your attention in terms of impacting the Valley?
Well, I look at Prop 48 for this, the obvious reason, but I think it depends on your point of view. If it you know, if we get if that casino's built, is that a does that open the floodgates for Native American casinos to proliferate off reservation downtown Fresno? And on the other hand, does it also bring economic prosperity to Madera County? Does it draw people? Does it start eroding away what chance you've already built? Like, you know, I think there's a lot of dynamics here and in play, and they all could have a great, great effect on our region.
Okay. Well, Professor Monroe, as the professor, you should and will get the last word. So which proposition you think is the most important for the Valley?
I don't know if it's going to be the most important, but for in the spirit of covering a little more ground, I'm going to point to Prop 47. And that's the initiative that's aiming at changing some felonies to misdemeanors. There's a continuing problem in the Valley and other parts of the state about the way that we sort of the overcrowding of jails and prisons, and so I think that has the potential to sort of mitigate some of that. Although there's also some, it could run the other way and to some extent as well in terms of crime. So that one has some implications for the Valley.
Well, I want to thank our guests. It's unfortunate we ran out of time. I wanted to talk about SB 1253, which made some significant changes to California's initiative process. It should really impact future propositions going forward. But I want to thank our guests, John Ellis, the political reporter for the Fresno Bee, Nate Monroe, a political science professor from UC Merced, and Pete Weber, a board member of California Forward and former executive committee chair of the California Partnership for the San Joaquin Valley. Thanks all of you for joining us. If you want to keep up to date with state and local politics, you can sign up for our free e-newsletter, The Matty Daily, by just logging on to our website at mattyinstitute.org.
The Matty Report Valley Views Edition is a public affairs partnership between KMJ Radio and the nonpartisan Matty Institute, providing the Valley with valuable insight and analysis on important public policy issues.
This is Mark Kepler for the Matty Report Valley Views Edition. Thanks for joining us.